You're listening to the Webcomic Beacon at webcomicbeacon.com.
Welcome to a special episode of the Webcomic Beacon Newscast. This episode is dedicated to the Charles Carrion versus what can only be termed the internet at this point. As you have heard before, there was an ongoing controversy. Started out with Charles Carrion sending a cease and desist letter to Matthew Inman of The Oatmeal, and exploded from there. We've talked about this case, and we will continue to talk about this case on the newscast, but there was something that really interested me at the early stages of this, and these were statements by Charles Carrion stating that he was absolutely confused, shocked that anyone would react negatively to a letter that he sent out. This letter, of course, was the one he sent to Matthew Inman, demanding that Inman take down all criticism of his client Funny Junk, as well as pay $20,000. And Carrion was absolutely shocked that anyone would be upset about that. That was a very curious sort of statement. Now, you can say a lot of things about Carrion, but he doesn't seem completely delusional. And we can argue that point later. So I was really curious why he would think such a letter would be acceptable. This led me to talk to other lawyers, and it brought up an even greater debate. And this is a debate that's going on the internet. It is a debate between free speech, the ability to say whatever you want, and the ability to defend and uphold your good name and reputation. These are two contradicting viewpoints, two things that are opposed to one another. And this really gets down to the basis of the case. So I actually went out and tracked down a few lawyers to talk about this. The first person I talked to was John Dozier, who has an internet law firm that focuses, who is on the side of the debate for the right of an individual to protect one's identity and reputation online. This is the less popular side of this debate, but it is still a valid place to come, and I was very pleased that John Dozier was willing to sit down with me and was such an open guy. He does have a very strongly held belief about these ideas, but at the same time, he is willing to talk and debate in an open forum, and I really do appreciate it. This was also the first interview I did on this topic, and it really did aid to my education. Really appreciate having him on, and we're going to listen to what he has to say.
Well, welcome to the special edition of the Webcomic Beacon podcast. We are talking to Mr. John Dozier here about the current legal fight between Funky Junk and The Oatmeal, and then expanding to the lawyer of Charles Carrion and Inman, the creator of the site. If you could tell us a little bit about yourself, and we'll get to the questions.
Well, my name is John Dozier. I'm with Dozier Internet Law, the founder of the law firm. All we do is the law of the internet, dealing with litigation. And prior to that, I founded some internet companies back in the early 90s and went through the internet bubble and raised venture capital and was chairman and CEO of various internet companies for about 10 years. Today, all we do now is litigation dealing with the web.
Thank you for coming on. We really appreciate you taking this time with us. And let's jump into this issue. Now, this issue started out with a letter being sent from the website Funny Junk to The Oatmeal regarding The Oatmeal making false accusations about the business practices of the of Funny Junk. And if you could talk about that letter, the initial letter that was sent out.
Well, my understanding is there was a demand letter issued. And not unlike many other demand letters that are issued, except for the fact that in the internet world, the response to a demand is often takes on a little different perspective than the typical response you might expect when you're not dealing with the internet.
Yeah.
So instead of a lawyer writing back and saying we disagree and or we agree or let's have a discussion about this, trying to resolve it in a businesslike and amicable way, oftentimes when you're dealing with the internet, it is very unique. And you get this type of response, which was basically the unleashing, whether intentional or not, of a Streisand attack.
Yeah.
Against the lawyer himself, you know, shoot the messenger. I mean, it's kind of distasteful in the first place for lawyers to have to defend themselves personally when they're dealing with a business transaction, and that seems to be the tendency for people to attack the messenger. But that is the way things are today, and there's free speech involved, and you have to understand that when you're dealing with the internet, issuing demand letters or issuing demands, that you have to keep in mind what the downside is, which is that it could be met with a counterattack that could be very effective.
Yeah. To speak on the demand letter, this is something that it does seem to be coming up, is the concept that this is a very common practice. And a lot of people who are not familiar with the law were really shocked by the letter, specifically the demand for compensation for the loss of business. That was one of the things that really shocked people. Is that a common practice in these demand letters to ask for compensation when it's sent out?
Yeah, the demand letters have never been something that on their face sound very credible, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of, I won't say never, but rarely. I mean, in a demand letter, it's kind of a wish list.
Mm.
So and you're throwing out all of the facts that you're putting out the facts that are all favorable to you and the law that's favorable to you and your interpretation of it. And because you don't know all the nuances, you oftentimes in a demand letter will ask for a lot more than you ever hope getting. So you can't really take these literally.
So it's sort of like the negotiations of the bazaar. You go in, you say, how much for this carpet? And they say $1 million, but that's really the starting point for negotiation. Is that a correct interpretation?
Exactly. That's exactly right. And oftentimes a demand letter is just a hope to intimidate the recipient into submission.
Hmm. And
it might not be the payment of any damages. It might just be stop doing what you're doing.
So,
but demand letters are very common. Now, there are a lot of different types now. If you're practicing internet law, you've probably developed a feel for what type of letter to write to whom. You have to do research as to who the recipient's going to be. And if you don't do that, then you're making a big mistake because that recipient may have a history of attack counterattacking or attacking messengers or being aggressive in their free speech views. So you need to understand that as you're drafting a demand letter and tailor it because you don't want these demand letters to be populating all over the web and make it look like all you do is just write a bunch of letters and then don't do anything about them.
Yeah.
So from a lawyer's standpoint, you do have to be much more careful than perhaps the attorney was in this instance.
Yeah, I can see that. And so the letter goes through, and obviously, as you stated, it's not even, it asks for everything that the party would want. It also preferentially chooses law to favor the client. Is that a correct statement about that?
Yes, it preferentially selects the, and views the law and the facts in the light most favorable to the client.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
In other words, the readers out there need to stop thinking that they can read these demand letters literally and get much out of them.
Yeah.
Because rarely are these demand letters very helpful in terms of where the cases or the matter is going to end up.
Okay.
It's just an invitation to begin discussions.
Yeah. Okay. Now, moving on to Inman's response, the way he responded was posting it online, like you said, and being attacking and also using what he considered humor in his response. What's your opinion on how that affects these sorts of disputes of posting, publicly posting the demand letters and the humor as well?
In this instance, it looks like he got him sued.
Yeah.
So that wasn't a really good result because it's expensive to get out of a lawsuit unless you get one of these free lawyers. I personally find it very distasteful when someone starts attacking the attorney for doing their job.
Right.
You know, we're hired to represent a party, and our job is to be as aggressive as possible in terms of representing the interests of the client.
Right.
So to somehow equate that to our, attacking our person and attacking our families, that's just absurd.
Right.
I totally fundamentally disagree with that. Does he have the free speech right to publish this? Even though there is a provision in the letter that says that it wasn't to be published, the answer is yes. It appears that he does have this free speech right to publish the demand letter unless it has been copyright protected.
So, I mean, the situation is he does have the legal right to do it, but it seems to have made the legal situation worse instead of improving the situation.
It's a very immature response to what might or might not be a serious legal dispute. I don't know enough about the merits of the situation to know.
Yeah. And one of the things I did want to move on is once this was posted online, there was a huge backlash. And at this point, it's just sort of spiraling out of control of the back and forth legal actions on this, where to the point where we have Charles Curran suing a great deal of a number of people involved in this case and sort of shocking people again.
Well, I wrote a book on this subject called Google Bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all about defamation and protecting your business and attacks and counterattacks.
Right.
And it lays out in detail exactly what's transpiring here. And it's it is the Streisand effect, and it's much more than that now. It's taken on both parties using the Streisand effect to some extent. But it's become a very, very ugly example of what Internet law is not about.
Yeah.
And it's become a very ugly example about what free speech is not about. Both of the parties, in my view, are absolutely wrong in what they're doing.
Right.
And eventually the judge is going to look at both of them, probably, and throw them out of court. And say, all you're doing is wasting our time. If you guys want to have, an immature hissy fit, go have it in the corners of the conference room between yourselves.
Right.
But this isn't the kind of thing that should be, clogging up the calendars of the courts.
Right. Well, there's one thing that has been brought up that I did want to ask you about, and this is the concept of slap laws and anti-slap laws. And people are bringing up this concept that there might be anti-slap procedures filed. In your experience, how likely are those to actually be effective?
Well, where is the lawsuit pending, Dina?
It's pending in California currently.
There's a slap statute in California state courts. Mm-hmm.
Right.
It's a very effective statute.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it very, very difficult to prevail in defamation cases in California.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That being said, there's a move to get slaps passed in other states. They're out there, and occasionally you'll run into one. And there's an effort in Washington to get a national slap statute, which basically is a motion that you file that can seek sanctions, a dismissal of a case and award of attorney's fees for strategic lawsuits against public participation.
Mm-hmm.
That's what SLAP is all about.
Yes.
So, they are very effective tools. They're threatened in almost every defamation case in California, and it's an issue.
It's an issue that it prevents the defamation cases from going forward, you're saying?
Well, yeah, you file it early in the case, and the court looks at it, and if it fits the criteria, the case is dismissed, and the court awards attorney's fees against you.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's a big deal.
Yeah. Now, one thing I wanted to ask about is there have been back and forth on the inclusion of charities into this argument. And the charities are actually ending up getting sued because of this. Mr. Inman's first response to this attack was saying he was going to open up a charity and linked his attack to the charity fundraising. And there have been sort of back and forth on both the merits and detriments of doing something like that.
Well, I'm not going to get into a discussion about whether or not there's something like that would be smart or meritorious.
Mm.
All I can say is suing these charities that are designated as the beneficiaries of contributions is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Unless they've been actively participating and supporting him so that they are seen as conspirators, there's no liability whatsoever. It's absurd.
Yeah.
Now, there may be something there that I'm not aware of, but if they're being sued simply because they were listed as a recipient for contributions, then that's ridiculous.
Yeah. Now, one of the problems in this case, in this situation, has been that the number of individuals have taken it upon themselves to engage in what are near illegal or illegal activities on behalf of the Oatmeal Comic, having harassing phone calls, impersonating Charles Karen. And two questions on this. How does the illegal activities affect Inman himself in his case? And also, what are more positive ways that people can engage in this process without actually crossing the line into illegal behavior?
All right, the first question was, how could he be held liable or responsible for the third party's actions?
Yeah.
The only way he could be liable for third parties is if he's seen as encouraging, promoting them such that they are acting as his agents.
Mm-hmm.
Or he is conspiring with them, and therefore their contact is imputed to him. And we won't know whether that's the case until you get back through and start looking at all his emails and see who he's been emailing. And if he's encouraging someone to go out and commit a criminal offense on his behalf, then he could have potential liability.
Right.
Civilly, criminally also.
Right.
He could be a co-conspirator. Your second question dealt with what?
What are positive ways for people to sort of let their voice be heard if they have an opinion on this?
Well, that depends on who you're asking. If you ask these free speech proponents, I call them free speech expansionists because all too often they are trying to expand the traditional doctrines of free speech.
Mm-hmm.
They believe that the appropriate way to do it is to be as boisterous and vocal and as possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, without violating the law, although some of them encourage legal violations. But my view on the other side of things is, and we represent parties on both sides of this type of litigation, but my view is allow the legal process to play its proper role. And if you want to have a voice in the legal process, there's a way to do it. You can ask leave to file briefs with the court. You have the right to comment. Fair comment is always constructive.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, crossing the line to publishing falsehoods or by implication inaccurate information just creates liability for the party who's publishing it. I would never recommend that. So, you know, a business-like handling of the matter where you would be proud or wouldn't be embarrassed if your mother was aware of the fact that you were behind it would be a good measure.
Right. yes, yeah, speaking of being behind it, some of the people involved with this have spoofed Charles Carrion on Twitter accounts, and he is demanding that their identity be released to him. And there's a lot of people who feel that there is a right to anonymity in these acts. What exactly is the law in the situation on a right to anonymity?
You have no right to anonymity if you violated the law.
Mm-hmm.
You have no right to anonymity if you are defaming someone.
Mm-hmm.
The battle becomes whether or not what has occurred fits into those categories.
Right.
And if you've made statements that might or might not be defamatory, then you can argue that to the judge in a motion to quash the subpoena that's issued to get that information. If someone has gone on and they have violated the law by creating an account in his name, holding them out as him, as you know, in California there's a specific statute on it that prohibits it, and other states have it too, then they're going to get, he's going to get all their identities, or at least he's going to get the IP addresses. And then once you have the IP addresses, you go to the ISP, and the ISP gives you the name of the person who was using the IP address at that date and time.
Well, there's one more question I did want to ask. The initial cause for the back and forth, and the initial thing that Inman was cited for was his complaints about the fact that his work was appearing on another website without citation. What would have been his best option to deal with that situation?
Well, first of all, you don't have to offer a citation
right, when
you use someone else's materials. But if someone has legitimately infringed on his client's copyright, then he can simply file a DMCA takedown notice, and that information would have been removed from their website.
The problem was, and this is the issue he brought up, is it was a YouTube sort of situation where it was user-posted content, and they were taking it down, but the moment they took it down, more content would be added by the individual users. And it was sort of...
Then you have to serve another DMCA takedown notice.
So the DMCA is the only way to get that stuff off of other sites. Is that correct?
Yeah, unless you file a complaint with YouTube and they agree to ban the users
okay, or
preclude any type of additional postings on that video, but then they go to create another video.
Yeah.
So it's quite a battle, but it's unusual to see that type of issue evolve into what you're describing. I mean, I've never had that happen. And now the minute that I say it, it'll happen next week.
Yeah.
You know, we issue a lot of DMCA takedown notices. Once in a blue moon, you'll get someone who has the audacity to try to relaunch the site or file a counter affidavit saying that they're not infringing, which are defenses to the DMCA takedown notice. But the notice is a very, very valuable, simple, easy-to-use tool. You don't get any money from it.
Right.
But you could also issue the, if you're really focused on trying to get compensation, you can issue a demand letter after you get it pulled down.
Okay. Well, I think this has been very informative and gave him a much broader view on this debate. Is there anything you would like to say in closing?
No, I just say that what you're saying here is a typical struggle that I wrote about a couple of years ago in my book, which is on the one side you have the law that is hasn't necessarily caught up to what the realities are of the operation of the web, and on the other side you have people who believe to unusual extents in exercising their rights to free speech, and this is the type of clash that is only natural with an evolving web that's really in its very early gestation phases. And these types of battles will establish the rules to play for in the future. No one's right or no one's wrong here. I think in the pure sense, this is just the type of thing that needs to play out. But other lawyers will look at this and probably change their conduct moving forward. And I have an entire chapter on my book on how to avoid, as a lawyer, you know, being attacked in this way. But on the other hand, the free speechers will also appreciate the fact that there's two sides to every story.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever the resolution is probably going to be mixed somewhere down the middle here, so that in the future people have better guidance as to what is and isn't, you know, an appropriate conduct for the web.
Well, thank you very much. This has been very informative. I really appreciate you taking the time to be on the show.
Well, thank you for the invitation. I appreciate it too.
So we heard opinions from John Dozier, and they were really well thought out and interesting opinions, but I wanted to get to the other side of the debate. I wanted to talk to a free speech advocate. John Dozier is focusing specifically on the rights of individuals to maintain their reputation, which are important rights, but there is an opposing idea here, free speech. So I went to a different lawyer, this one by the name of Kenneth White, also known online as Popat, and has written extensively about the Charles Carrion case, and he gave me a lot of interesting information as well. So we're now going to listen to this interview and see what the opposing side of this debate is. It turns out it's not so much opposing, but it is a different view of the issues. Well, welcome back. This is Eric again, and this time I'm here with Ken White, yet again talking about the Carrion suit versus the oatmeal and some of the issues that come up around it. Ken White, if you could introduce yourself, tell us a little about yourself.
Sure. My name is Ken White. I'm an attorney at a small firm in Los Angeles. I used to be a federal prosecutor when I started my legal career. Went from there to a number of big firms before a friend and I started our own shop about 7 years ago. And recently I've been getting more and more into First Amendment issues and defense of defamation cases, which I find very enjoyable. I blog at a site called Popat.com. And one of my hobbies is connecting threatened bloggers with pro bono representation, which has been very rewarding.
Yeah, that is a very rewarding career, and I think we all appreciate your work. We are here talking about the Carrion case, and I just want to start off here, because one of the things that happened at the very beginning, Charles Carrion sent a cease and desist letter. And that's what really set the internet on edge. And in a number of quotes, Carrion expressed utter shock that anyone would have gotten upset about the letter, stating along the lines that it was just sort of standard business. And I'm sort of curious how these cease and desist letters usually work, just in a general sense. Was Carrion's letter somewhat ordinary in that sense?
I would have to say that it is, and perhaps not from someone who styles himself as an internet lawyer who ought to know about the Streisand effect, mm-hmm. but it's not too different from any number of cease and desist letters I've seen, both as an attorney and as a blogger writing about legal threats against bloggers and against newspapers and things like that. Unfortunately, a number of lawyers, for whatever reason, don't really seem to grasp the impact that something like this has now, that the so-called Streisand effect will reliably mean that the expression you are challenging is going to be seen by orders of magnitude more people.
And so one of the curious things was it seemed like he was demanding something that was impossible to comply with. And many people read that as he just wants to go to lawsuit. He doesn't want to negotiate. Is that sort of how that worked, or was there something more to this letter for negotiation?
It's hard to say. It's always dangerous to impute too much careful thought into a demand letter from a lawyer. Maybe they have a strategy mapped out. Maybe they're just sending it to please a client. Maybe they really haven't thought it through at all. Here, certainly, it looked as if he wanted at least the comic down that Matthew Inman had written earlier about Funny Junk. And maybe that was his ultimate goal, and the $20,000 demand was just a way of getting the discussion started. That would be typical.
So it's sort of typical for a lawyer to ask for something that they would never get just so they have something to give up. Is that sort of how it works?
Definitely. Lawyers in every circumstance, in any legal setting, often start out demanding high, expecting the bargain down. And particularly one of the things that makes me enjoy working in this area and enjoy connecting threatened bloggers and artists with pro bono work is that the initial demand can be so intimidating and terrifying to someone who hasn't had a lot of experience with the legal system. Sometimes it's not really clear to a non-lawyer whether this means they've already been sued, often the person doesn't know whether these are good claims or not, whether in fact they have done something that might subject them to liability. And, certain types of lawyers will send letters that are really not sent in good faith, that are based on claims that really don't have much legal merit and are really intended to terrify you into taking the site down, stopping the communication, before you can get legal advice.
So a lot of times these are sent out just to intimidate the other party, and that's why they have the sort of strong wording?
Yes, and you'll see frequently that when the Streisand effect comes into play, lawyers get backed off all the time now as they realize that it's just not going to work. And the beauty of it is that a lawyer who is advising their client now might have to say, we really didn't expect this response, and now 20 blogs are talking about it, and the thing you didn't want people to see, 100 times more people are seeing it, so I recommend we not make it 10,000 times and not file suit.
Now, are lawyers having to change the way they do business because there are individuals now who can broadcast things so far so quickly?
I think prudent lawyers are. Certainly prudent lawyers who promote themselves as being internet savvy or, being able to advise clients about internet issues. Because as you've seen in this case, as you could see in any number of cases out there, just today I wrote about one of the owners of the Miami Heat bringing a new lawsuit to demand that someone take down an unflattering picture of him, and that unflattering picture is going to be seen by hundreds of thousands or millions more people than otherwise would have seen it as a result of that threat. And so I think lawyers now are, many of them, the savvy ones, backing away from that as a tactic.
So, not to go too much into this, but let's say you are you do have a legitimate complaint with a blogger saying, a blogger says something that is quite clearly inflammatory and quite clearly false, but also this blogger has a great deal of reach. How would you go about asking them to take it down in that case when they do have that sort of mob appeal at their side?
That's a good question, because as much as I'm a defender of the First Amendment and as much as I try to help bloggers in these circumstances, sometimes people do publish things that are false and harmful, and the law does provide a remedy for that. I think that a softer approach is called for in that situation. A lawyer might research to see whether this person has legal counsel already and reach out to them privately. If they're forced to, they might send a letter that is more along the lines of, we've seen this post, we believe it has serious factual misstatements, we're willing to share the evidence we have that has serious factual misstatements. If you're interested in accuracy, we'd like an opportunity to discuss it with you. That's not a terrifying type of demand, and it's not one that tends to get the backup of the person you're sending it to. Some very aggressive lawyers who are sort of invested in being aggressive would say that that sounds too soft and would find it a very difficult thing to do. I think that's being too focused on yourself and your style as a lawyer and not focused enough on what the actual best interests of the client are, because it really doesn't serve a client who's actually been defamed to have that defamation spread 10, 100 times. So a softer approach, one that acknowledges perhaps that the person you're writing to has First Amendment rights, but representing that you have a good case to show them about why they're wrong about something, is the approach that I might take in that situation.
Okay.
The other thing I would say is that one of the things you see most frequently in frivolous legal demands is vagueness. So, people get a letter saying, you wrote a post and this is defamatory and I demand you take it down, but it doesn't specify any facts in the post that are untrue and doesn't specify any evidence showing that they're untrue. People tend to toss that out or regard it as frivolous. So if a lawyer, I think, has a real case, then it's a good idea for them to be very specific about what in the post is wrong.
So to be a little more soft, but at the same time have a lot more detail in the letter works better.
Sure. Sure. If I were crafting one of these, I might say something like, you know, your client has said, expressed some very negative opinions about my client. We don't think they're fair, but they're protected by the First Amendment. However, the following false statements you've made are not protected by the First Amendment because they're false statements of fact, and we can prove they're false, and here they are.
Okay.
That type of specificity, I think, is just good legal practice, unless, of course, you're a lawyer who is just trying to intimidate someone and doesn't actually have a case.
Mm. Now, going on to the sort of reaction, obviously, after this blew up, it just went crazy. And I'd like to just ask yet again, generally, what is your advice when things start to get in the beginning of a Streisand effect sort of situation? What is your general advice there?
Well, are you asking me in terms of what if you're the person who made the threat that's now going viral or the person who was threatened?
Well, I mean, the person, I guess we'll go from both ends. What would be the ideal situation if you are threatened, and what's the ideal situation if you're threatened by
okay.
a letter that you can tell was meant to intimidate and doesn't have factual basis?
Well, then I think, first of all, it's always a good idea to reach out and get counsel. And I know that's easy for me to say, being a lawyer, and people are thinking that means I just want to make money. But the truth is that when you're threatened with a lawsuit, it's a good idea to get some advice. And there are people out there like the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Public Citizen, a number of private lawyers who have written to me when I've asked for help, who will offer help to people. Second of all, I think it really increasingly behooves people to say very specifically when they publish the letter and write about it, I want to encourage my readers not to harass this person, not to threaten them, not to play obnoxious pranks, not to do anything that reflects badly on the core of what this is, which is a free speech issue. Unfortunately, the greater I won't use the full term that Penny Arcade uses. Let's call it the greater Internet fellow theory applies, and there's always going to be some core number, 1% or 0.5% or 10%, who are going to react to something like this by acting like jerks. Whether that's sending hateful things, whether it's sending actually threatening things, whether it's making prank calls, whatever it is, I think it's good for people to say, look, I don't want any part of that. If you're going to write this person objecting to the threat, write respectfully. There are two reasons for that. One is I think it's the right thing to do. And second, as we see in the Oatmeal and Funny Junk case, if bad behavior occurs, it's going to be used by the other side as part of a narrative to shift the focus away from, this was a bogus legal threat meant to shut down criticism to, oh, poor me, I sent a perfectly legitimate legal letter and now I'm being threatened by strangers on the Internet.
Can you be held responsible for the actions of pretty much strangers on the Internet who just happen to like you?
I haven't seen any authority that supports the suggestion that you can. I believe that the applicable rule would be the one for incitement in general, and that's a case called Brandenburg versus Ohio from decades ago. And what the Supreme Court said was that speech is not unlawful incitement unless it is meant to and likely to incite imminent serious unlawful action. So, if you're talking to a mob and you say, let's go hang these guys, that's clearly illegal. If you're having a, if you have a blog and you're having a philosophical discussion about whether violence is ever morally justified, that's not illegal. And certainly if you're just criticizing someone and saying, this person's a punk, this person's a jerk, you can't be legally responsible just because one of your readers is a nut and decides to act on that. I mean, if the central theory that Charles Carrion in this case seems to be advancing is that people on the internet are legally responsible for the consequences of harsh criticism, satire, parody, tough language. And that can't be the rule because, first of all, it would mean the more followers you have, the more legal liability you have and the less you could talk. And second of all, it would mean the more loathsome somebody's behavior out there, the less you can say about it, because the more likely it is some nut out there is going to do something illegal. But that's not the law.
Okay, so let's look at the other side of things. Let's say you have sent out a respectful cease and desist letter about factual errors, but then the party misrepresents your statements and gets a huge mob sort of going to, against your cause and your clients. What is a good response at that point?
Well, hopefully you've advised your client of the risks in terms of making the threat in the first place. Mm-hmm. And if you fail to do so, then I think at that point you call your malpractice insurance carrier and do a little praying. Past that, I think that what you do is you make to whatever media is covering it a very calm, respectful case for this is what we actually sent. We thought it was a fair request. Here's the evidence we have that this person has made false statements. If they're not interested in taking it down because it's not right, then we'll have to decide whether or not to resort to the courts. In other words, be the grown-up in the situation.
Is there a place for apology, or does that weaken your hand too much?
Well, it depends on what you want to do. If you want to go ahead and sue, then maybe not. But if you decide you're not going to sue and that this is terrible, then yes. And you could frame the apology as, you know, my letter was not intended to chill speech. It was rather out of a sincere belief that this person had said something false that hurt my client, who after all is a human being too. So there are a number of ways you can reframe it and try to change people's minds. I mean, you know, in any situation in life, or particularly on the internet, people are going to make up their minds and 50% of them are never going to be moved again. But you can move some people some of the time.
Okay. So let's talk about the other people who sort of jumped on the bandwagon. Charles Carrion named a yet-to-be-determined individual who spoofed him on Twitter. And I do know that there were quite a number of people who were just sort of making fun of him. If you could talk a little bit about how satire is protected speech and how that ropes into Hustler magazine, I think that would be sort of interesting.
Absolutely. Satire and parody are very broadly protected, thank goodness, in American law. And the Hustler case you refer to is probably one of the most cited and most important and core cases in American law about satire and parody. That was Jimmy Falwell suing Hustler magazine. Hustler magazine had run an ad that was a satire of I think it was Campari campaign. Campari had a ad campaign where people talked about their first time, a reference to sex pretty clearly. And Hustler ran one suggesting that Falwell's first time was a drunken encounter with his mother in an outhouse. It said at the bottom, parody. But Falwell sued. He was not amused, both on his own behalf, on behalf of his late mother. And ultimately, the Supreme Court did talk about how broadly satire and parody was protected. And it was very clear that it was not to be meant to be taken as a literal statement about Falwell. Rather, it was a satirical attack on him. That rule has continued with very few exceptions, and you even see it in some areas as an exception to copyright, to trademark, and to otherwise broad rules like that. So, for instance, You can't use somebody's trademark to make money directly, but you can use it to satirize them. You can't, you know, make a TV show that is a complete ripoff of, say, The West Wing and call it The West Wing, but you can make a satire show that is a satire of, you know, Aaron Sorkin type shows in general. And these things come into play definitely in this oatmeal and funny junk story. Whether with the satirical Twitter accounts, or with the satirical website that's out there, particularly for things that are, A, clearly not meant to be taken at face value, but meant as satire, and B, not commercial. The protection is clearly quite broad, and I think that Mr. Carrion is going to have a real problem going after that. I sent you a link, and I think that you're going to publish it for your listeners, to the Citizen Media Law Project, and they have a page, actually, on copyright and trademark with a section on it about satire that kind of gives some guidelines and some ideas, and I find it to be an excellent resource.
That is an excellent resource, and we will be publishing that, and I appreciate you sending those. One thing I do want to, one more talk about the Twitter account. There is a threat of subpoenaing Twitter's logs and a couple other websites simply to learn the identity of the person who made the satirical account. What expectation of anonymity can people have on the net? Is there any protection for anonymity?
You know, it's a question. I'm going to give you everyone's least favorite answer from a lawyer. That depends. It's an area of the law that is in flux. It's been in flux for 10 years. It varies wildly, depending on the terms of use of, you know, whatever the entity is that's being subpoenaed. But increasingly, a lot of the big players like Twitter and Google and others fight hard to maintain the anonymity of their users because they want they don't want people to abandon them to someplace that won't protect anonymity. And the law in different jurisdictions, in the federal courts, the various state courts, is changing. In some places, increasingly, courts require people seeking to unmask anonymous commenters to make a certain showing that their claim has merit before they order the person unmasked. Oftentimes, the anonymous commenter can intervene, come in still anonymously, represented by counsel, and fight the order to unmask them. So I think that's a positive development because it doesn't make a lot of sense for anyone to be able to unmask somebody just by virtue of having sued them without any sort of test of whether or not the case has merit.
Okay. And moving on to other protections, you've spoken quite a bit about anti-slap laws. Could you explain what an anti-slap law is and why we want these laws on the books?
Of course. A SLAP is an acronym for Strategic Lawsuit Against Public Participation. The classic slaps were from real estate development companies that would sue local citizens who were protesting or opposing big developments or rezoning or things like that. And it came to a point where in some places it was very economically hazardous to get into the debate about what should or should not be built in your neighborhood. So some states have started to pass laws that basically give people in a defamation suit an early chance to get rid of the suit. A description of in general in state and federal court how you can or can't get rid of a suit early would take forever. I'm not going to subject you to that. But here's what an anti-slap statute does. If you are sued for anything that really goes towards your speech, it allows you to make a motion in court and say, you know, this lawsuit is directed at my speech. You know, it's a defamation suit or it's a intentional infliction of emotional distress or, you know, it's a copyright suit, but it actually goes to satire. And then under these statutes, the burden shifts to the plaintiff, the person bringing the suit, and they have to put forward some evidence saying, I have a real claim here. It's not just harassment. I have a chance of being able to prevail. And in many states, if you are a defendant and you bring that motion and you win, then you get your attorney's fees paid, which, of course, is not the normal American rule. This is a great tool. In the case of the states that have strong anti-SLAPP statutes like California and Texas, it's really making some inroads, I think, against harassing use of the courts. And it really gives plaintiffs something they have to think about seriously before they file suit. Now, there's an organization called the Public Participation Project, and I give you a link to them, and it has a great graph that shows all the different states and what the different laws are. A number of states don't have an anti-SLAPP law, and some have very weak ones. Take something like Maryland, where the statute only protects activities that are petitioning the government. By comparison, California and Texas, pretty much anything that's a discussion of a public issue is going to be protected by the statute. There's also been for a while an effort to pass a federal anti-SLAPP statute so that no matter where you are in the country, if someone sues you, if your state doesn't have an anti-SLAPP statute, you could move the case to federal court and defend it there under the federal statute.
Mm-hmm. And that is currently we can go to that same link to look into that national standard, correct?
Yes, the Public Participation Project has some language about it. The latest proposal is called the Petition Act, and it's stuck in some committee or other someplace.
Okay. I want to go on to one statement, and this is something that I found really interesting. Charles Carrion stated that he doesn't care if he's popular. That's not his job. And he just is going to be a lawyer. What effect does popular outcry have on laws and lawsuits, if any?
Well, it has an effect along a number of routes. I mean, first of all, a prudent plaintiff is not going to engage in a lawsuit that really hurts their popularity and their bottom line. Someone like Mr. Carrion might not be as moved by that. Second of all, a big high publicity suit like this helps people convince state legislatures to pass anti-SLAPP laws. Third, the general publicity given to something like this inevitably affects the judiciary, the judges, their law clerks, everyone. They see it and it forms sort of the background of what they think of when they have a defamation case in front of them. I also think that the discussion of cases like this is good, and it's one of the reasons that I try to blog a lot about legal threats and things like that. This sort of thing works when people don't stand up for themselves. This sort of thing works when people don't really take First Amendment rights too seriously or don't really think much about what their rights are or don't educate themselves about their rights. There's a great quote by a famous judge named Learned Hand, who was giving a speech in a day when many new citizens were being naturalized in New York. And he said that if you don't have freedom in your heart, then no court can protect it. And I think that's true, that unless we keep people believing in the concept of a robust practice of free speech and the good in the courts protecting it, then it doesn't really matter how well the legal protections work, because jurors won't vote the right way, judges won't vote the right way, people won't think to protect their rights.
Yeah. Speaking on what individual people can do, there are over 14,000 people who have contributed to Inman's charity. There are a far greater number of people who are very upset about this particular legislation, and the internet is not very good with delayed gratification. What things can people do right now that are legal and not devolving into hooliganism?
That's a good question. A number of things. I think the charities that Matthew Inman chose are great, but there are also charities out there that assist in defending people's free speech rights. Among them, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Public Citizen, the ACLU, FIRE, which is the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education. If people want to make a contribution to those, I think that goes a long way. People can educate themselves about free speech issues. For instance, figure out by going to that Public Participation Project page whether your state has an anti-SLAPP law, and if it doesn't, you know, write your local representative and ask them why. Write your congressman or senator and ask them to support the Petition Act in Congress. Help spread the word when you hear about a situation like this where someone is being threatened with a frivolous legal threat, and, you know, be part of the Streisand effect, hopefully in a positive way. And, you know, most of all, defend the free speech of someone whose opinion you really hate. You know, stand up for an opinion you don't like and help to promote the idea that it's not about our side versus your side, but about this is a core idea for our society that we protect speech that upsets us, speech that may be distasteful, even speech that may be hateful, and we do it whether or not we agree with the person on the other side or not.
Well, I think that is an excellent place to wrap up our little talk. I'm going to mention the links that you mentioned again. There is the Citizens Media Law Project at citmedlaw.org. There is the Public Participation Project at anti-slap.org. We talked about the Hustler versus Falwell debate, and we will have a link to that. And we also got to remind everyone, if they want to learn more about these sorts of things, to check out your blog at popehat.com.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate that you're taking this into the arena of a free speech discussion and for you spreading the word about it.
And we appreciate you coming on. It was very informational and very inspiring.
My pleasure.
So we've heard from Kenneth White, we've heard from John Dozier, and while their opinions do vary, I was most interested by the things that were the same. For example, both of them stated quite equivocally that a cease and desist letter is not to be taken 100% seriously. It is a beginning point for arguments. It is a place that lawyers put in their wish list. If you were thinking of the magic genie, it would be your first wish for wishing for infinite wishes. Once that failed, then you would have a negotiation down. This is the way lawyers do things. Now, the problem we had here is that this directly conflicts with the way the internet does things. And I'll talk a little bit about that once we get past our last interview, because I wanted to get an internet viewpoint. So I went to someone who has dealt with this issue online. This is Jeremy Bennell. He runs sexyfur.com, which is an adult site, and adult sites are places that often have their content stolen. And he got into a legal dispute with an individual who was stealing his content. He then dealt with it in a different manner after the legal dispute did not work too well. He has his opinions on Charles Carrion, as do most people, but I wanted to get his opinions on all these things. So we're now going to listen to his side of this story from a non-legal standpoint, but looking at the internet standpoint.
So welcome back. It's Eric again. This time we're talking to Jeremy Bennell. Yet again, we're talking about the Carrion versus Oatmeal case. Jeremy has some unique perspectives, and I'll let him introduce himself. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Jeremy.
I'm the founder of sexyfur.com and tailheat.com, pay websites for adult furry content. Been running Sexyfur since 2000, and I guess we've had our fair share of harassment and pirates, etc., over the years. So,
all right. So you said you had some opinions on the whole case, so I'll let you get that out of your system first. What is your opinion on this whole thing?
Well, it's, first of Well, I guess it's just absolutely ridiculous from so many perspectives. These funny jack people are complete hypocrites. Just to put it in a base perspective, you know, here they're... Yeah, we've had our trouble with funny junk as well. And you know, here their lawyer is saying, you know, I think satirical content is fine, but him accusing my mother of bestiality is revolting, and I will not forgive it. But, you know, it's okay for them to post our art with, you know, that kind of stuff in it on their website. And, you know, their lawyer for funny junk is... You know, he wants to be, where is this, the quote I'm looking for here? It says he wants to be the go-to guy for people who feel cyber vandalized or similarly wronged on the internet. And, you know, it's completely the pot calling the kettle black there.
Yeah. It is a very weird case. One of the things I did want to ask you about, you have had your stuff stolen, and when you tried to deal with it, you got a backlash for that. Was that correct?
Oh, it's a backlash that continues to this day, yeah.
Could you explain a little bit of what's going on?
It happened... through a couple of different people, one of which is the infamous Saib, a.k.a. Ross Reddick, who's now in jail, who was going around doing BitTorrents and IRC rips of comic books and websites and, you know, things that people were trying to make money on. And he ripped our site, and I, you know, I asked him nicely several times, you know, stop doing this. And he, you know, it's kind of rude to repeat the things that he stated, but it was in disagreement with us. So I decided to take him to court and sue him for copyright infringement. And that opened basically like kicking the hornet's nest.
Mm.
He enlisted all his little goons and cronies, and, you know, we've been harassed ever since. And then I did it again with the Lulz crowd, and the same result, even worse, actually.
Yeah. And this is one of the things that was brought up, is that if Inman had a problem with funny junk, he should have just gone through legal channels.
Well, the thing is, he tried doing it in his... own way, which was peaceful and non-litigatory, by stating on his web, hey, you know, these guys are being jerks. That was it. And, you know, all the people who supported him went after funny junk on their own. And, you know, yeah. I'm sure he'll get accused by the people who side with funny junk of, already has been accused of inciting sort of a rebellion. Even if he didn't, and, you know, that kind of same stuff has happened with me. You know, I've pointed out people saying, you know, look at this guy, he's on this site and he's posting my own stuff with his name on it, you know, how ridiculous is this? And then other people go and on their own volition, they, you know, criticize the people who do that stuff, and then I get the backlash for it. So, it's just how it works, you know, people...
So it's really hard to fight the copyright infringement online.
It's difficult because cases like that, they usually have to go to a federal venue, which means state Supreme Court. You know, most small courts deal with divorces and people arguing over, you know, whose fence is too close to whose property and this crap. They don't have the time or the knowledge to deal with copyright cases. So even if you file cases like that in a smaller court, it ends up going up to higher courts. And that takes a long time. It takes a lot of money. And it is for this reason that the DMCA was put in place to begin with, so that, you know, there was a paper trail where, you know, okay, yes, you can inform ISPs that their stuff contains unauthorized material, and then they have a time to take it down without anybody needing to go through litigation, and it makes it fast and efficient. But, you know, asking people nicely doesn't work, and then when you send them a DMCA, which is just a formal letter of announcement, they take that as, you know, oh, you're being an evil, you know, litigious prick, and, you know, mm-hmm. we're going to go after you for this.
So we had a little break up there, but we were talking about the problems of having DMCA requests being used against you and having legal methods in the courts taking a really long time. So is there a solution to copyright theft, or do we have to just accept it?
Well, there are quite a few new solutions that are coming out from the private market in terms of steganography and copy protection. The problem is that a lot of, you know, media machine, like hardware stuff, especially like PlayStation, Xbox, DVD players and things, have to incorporate this stuff into their technology. There's a new steganographic algorithm that hides a signal in the soundtrack of a movie, so that when it's either recorded, you know, ripped through DVD rip or duplicated from a DVD or even filmed in a camera in a movie theater, that signal will remain in the movie, and then when a player detects it, it'll stop playback. It's pretty neat, and it's imperceptible to the human ear, but, you know, it's a frequency that'll, you know, it'll survive throughout multiple copies of the content. And it's very neat. But the thing is, of course, some people are going to write a video player that can completely bypass it. So, you know, you're always going to have a certain portion of the population that's going to pirate things. As far as I can see, the only way to deal with the problem without litigation is for content creators to protect their own material through cutting off access to people who steal the stuff. In other words, watermark, steganographic encoding of data in the images, you know, basically so you can catch the person that's redistributing your stuff and cut off their content.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there was an argument that saying what we need is more laws.
No, there's already enough laws on the books. It's just that the system to enforce them is slow and cantankerous, and, mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't work. There's some new stuff that's called judge.me, which is, you know, international sort of a free market, open market litigation service. Mm-hmm. That, you know, their rules, their rulings, rather, are respected in quite a number of different countries. And, you know, people can agree to, you know, go there to argue with a, you know, basically it's just like arguing a case in front of a judge. You know, they both have to agree to abide by the decision of the judge. But again, you know, these pirates are going to say screw. You know, we're going to continue to steal your stuff. They're not going to cooperate with it. But, yep. you know, if a judgment from this service happens to be valid in the country where these pirates are residing, you know, you can actually get them in some real trouble. So, you know, that's a potential help. But, you know, again, it goes to, you have so many jurisdictions that not all agree. Mm-hmm. Whether something is a crime or not, or, you know, they have varying degrees with which they can enforce certain things, and they may or may not have the resources or time or even interest in going after these people.
Now, what about what Inman did of simply publicly shaming the people who are stealing the copyright? Obviously, that doesn't work well for torrents and the more anonymous and less centralized ones, but is that an effective method?
I think it might be. You know, that goes back to the dawn of civilization and how, you know, people could be ostracized from their tribe for being idiots or not mm-hmm. pulling their weight. So, you know, I think he did the right thing. Why not?
All right. moving on from copyright, talking a little bit about harassment, because one of the things Carrion is saying is, I want to be, you know, this is all about harassment. And like you said, there is a lot of harassment, even when you have a legitimate complaint, that you can get really harassed. What is your feeling on legal recourses for harassment online?
Well, define harassment. It's a very vague thing to define. And, you know, from what I've seen of what Inman did, that's not harassment. He's right. Basically calling these people out and saying, look, these people are idiots. And
yeah. But the funny drunk in their own right said that Inman was trying to shut down their site and told their people to harass him on Facebook.
Load of crap.
Right. Should there have been something that should there have been a legal recourse at that point?
I don't think so, because I thought it was completely fallacious. You know, I don't think that was true. I don't think they have any proof that he had tried to incite things on his website or on Facebook.
No, it was should Inman have had some recourse back, or yet again, is the public shaming the best way to deal with it?
I think the public shaming is the best way to deal with it. Nobody has to go to court, and, you know, if you can prove your point and other people can get behind it and see the truth, I mean, obviously that, obviously the case is that Funny Junk is at fault. I mean, they're basically taking this guy's work and trying to make money on it. That's not cool. Nowhere in the world that's cool. And, well, you know, they're getting their just rewards for that, and so there's no. I'm not going to cry any tears for them.
So, how did you actually deal with it when you had people kind of targeting you for simply taking people to court?
Well, in my case, I had to fight back with the same technique they were fighting me with. You know, they were calling me at 2 in the morning and leaving, basically packing my voicemail so full that I couldn't use it. Mm-hmm. You know, and I had to find out who they were and do things like send balloon bouquets to them with congratulations, you know, cards. basically say, I know who you are, I know where you live, and you're not as anonymous as you think you are. And that curbed quite a bit of it, but... yeah, it still didn't stop the hate mongering and you know, basically Burnell bashing on the net. Yeah, there's nothing you can do about that.
So
that stuff has a life of its own, you know.
But it sounds like the way you dealt with it was with humor.
I tried to do it with humor because you take them to court, yeah, you win a judgment, yes, they have an injunction against them, and if they ever do it again and you catch them doing it, then you have a warrant for their arrest federally, and anywhere they go, put in jail. But you know, then they can just get one of their minions to do it for them, and well, nothing about it.
But when you used humor, it sort of de-escalated the situation.
I'd say it was successful a little bit, yeah. I mean, it's the equivalent of public shaming.
That's about what I had to ask for, ask you. Is there anything you wanted to talk about?
No, I can't think of anything. I mean, if you have specific questions about this case or about other stuff.
Well, I can't exactly ask you if suing the cure for cancer is a good idea. I think I know your answer.
It's pretty stupid. They have nothing to do with it, you know. And then this other stuff, like he says, you know, Inman and his website can't possibly be an authentic, you know, charity collect. Like, well, what? What kind of crap is that? That's a ridiculous allegation.
Yeah.
In here, the quote, Inman is not qualified to be a charity fundraiser, saying they're not registered with the Attorney General's Registry of Charitable Trust. It's like he's not collecting the money.
Yeah.
Indiegogo is collecting the money. You know, it's ridiculous.
Now,
absolutely ridiculous.
One of the things it seems like he's almost trying to do is collectively punish the internet. Because he's suing these charity foundations, it seems like simply so that they won't get any money.
This guy's an ambulance chaser. And, you know, he's going to go with his little plan, whether or not he's proved wrong. And even if he is proved wrong, he'll, continue to act like he's the champion of internet people. Meanwhile, you know, all he's doing is protecting a thief and crapping all over somebody that actually makes good content.
Yeah. And raises quite a bit of money for charity as well.
Right, yeah, $180,000. I think it's even higher at this point. But,
it's over $200,000.
Oh, wow, yeah.
I mean, have you ever seen someone go after everyone on the internet like this?
It depends on what side you're going after. I mean, the internet is a constant attack by American politicians and European politicians in terms of, killing the freedom. Mm-hmm. And, government is not the way to do it. I think private industry find a way to sort through all this stuff eventually.
So you think technology is the solution to these problems?
Oh, absolutely. Technology is the only solution. We've seen how terribly the government handles things at all turns. And, it will only sound like a hypocrite saying that because I use the government to sue these people. But the thing is, that was my only recourse at the time.
Mm-hmm. And it didn't go too well, until you started.
Yeah, you smack two guys, and then it makes thousands of their minions angry. So, it's not very productive. We have other ways to get them, We develop technology to, watermark images and hide data in images and, catch people that we're stealing from.
Hmm. Well, I'd like to thank you for coming on. Anything else you want to say?
No, can't think of anything. But, if you figure out any other questions you got, just give me a call.
I definitely will. Thank you very much. And I'd like to appreciate you while you coming here. Would you like to plug any sites one last time?
Check out sexyfur.com and tailheat.com. We also have a couple of new art books I put through Fur Planet Publishing. You can find them on their website. And I think that's about it.
All right. Thank you very much.
This concludes the interviews that I conducted here. I get a little time now to sort of give my analysis of what's going on. The first thing I want to talk about is the idea that lawyers consider these rather threatening letters to be perfectly ordinary, and to be a perfectly ordinary part of the practice. And if you really think about what a lawyer has to do, a lawyer has to get people to stop doing something that their client thinks is wrong. Lawyers not hired to represent the truth. They're hired to represent their client. And they're hired to represent their client as cheaply as possible. So they send out threatening letters so that you will pay attention, so that you will contact them as quickly as possible and resolve things as quickly as possible. That's in the benefit for their client. They intentionally skew the facts and skew the information so that their client looks the best and their case looks the strongest. Because if they sent you a letter that looked like it was unimportant or they were unsure of themselves, you would simply ignore it. You'd throw it in the trash. This costs their client money. They don't want to go to court, and so it's in their best interest to scare you, to force you to get counsel as quickly as possible, to resolve things through the legal method. So when Carrion said he was absolutely shocked about the response, in one sense he's correct, because he was acting under the legal standpoint. However, he also sold himself as an internet lawyer. Funny Junk hired him as an internet lawyer, and as an internet lawyer, he should have known better. And I really see what's going on here as a clash of two systems. There are two systems to resolving conflict. There is the legal system. The legal system is a system of attrition. Both sides hire lawyers, they negotiate with one another, slowly coming down to some sort of middle point. There is pressure on both sides because the longer they take to reach a resolution, the more it costs in legal fees. This is the solution. This is the way the legal system works. Legal system works on a system that, quite frankly, is bullying. Each side tries to bully each other. Each side tries to misrepresent the facts. And slowly, they whittle each other down to a center position. It's how it's worked. It's how it's always worked. Now, there's obviously some flaws here. This is ideally a war of attrition where both sides have equal costs. But in the case of Charles Carrion, where Charles Carrion is a lawyer, the costs are unequal. Charles Carrion is paying nothing for his frivolous lawsuits, and he is abusing the legal system. He can because it's a lawyer. It's a system that favors lawyers in their arguments and their disagreements. Innately unfair in that case, but if it's not a lawyer system, and we're not talking about wealthy individuals, then you have a system that works pretty well. It doesn't work for the wealthy or for those who have access to inexpensive legal care, such as lawyers. The internet has its own system to resolve conflict. It has a system of lightning-fast attacks on each other, where the legal system is a siege warfare. The internet is a blitzkrieg. It thrives on satire and humor. It thrives on belittling your opponent. And it works on a system of public shaming, where you make your opponent look as bad as possible with the facts. The internet system does not like misrepresenting the facts, because you'll be found out and it will be turned back upon you, and doesn't like bullying. It's satire and humor that works. So we have two systems that have two distinctly different methods of resolving the conflict. The internet uses satire, humor, and belittling the other person. The legal system uses bullying and a wars of attrition, and takes satire and humor and makes it worse. Each system, their basic method, bullying in legal and humor in the internet, are anathema to the other. And what happened is Charles Carrion didn't do his research. He didn't know that there was an existing conflict between Funny Junk and the Oatmeal. He didn't know that Funny Junk was currently still illegally hosting the Oatmeal's content. He didn't do his research. He didn't do his research to a point that rises to the level of malpractice. He simply did not represent his clients well. And what happened is, when this hit the fan, when things went bad, Charles Carrion had a choice. He either admitted that he was incompetent, or he had to say that Inman cheated. That the reason things went so bad was not because he didn't understand the internet system of resolving things, but simply because Inman had done something wrong. And the way he made that case was to sue. He doesn't care if he wins. He is interested in his reputation at this point. He is trying to cover up his, quite frankly, malpractice level of incompetence when dealing with this issue. And if there is any justice in the world, the Funny Junk is going to come in and save us. They are going to come in, sue Charles Carrion for malpractice because he has done extensive damage to their business model, and the man will be disbarred. That would actually redeem the Funny Junk, because they would have gotten rid of someone who is a complete menace to us all. But there's sort of a bigger issue here, beyond just one lawyer who didn't do his homework, in that both lawyers that I've talked to have admitted that lawyers are going to have to change the way they do business. They are going to have to be aware that you can have this situation where you send out a letter that is normal practice in legal law to scare a person to getting counsel, and instead of getting counsel, you're giving them fodder for this secondary system, the internet system. You're giving them the ability to use your letter as an attack on your client and to do extensive damage to the business model of your client. This goes beyond a Streisand effect. Carrion has really invented his own effect, a Carrion blunder of sorts, that when you do something that not only publicizes something you want to cover up, but gives your opponent something, ammunition to fundamentally damage the business of your clients. Funny Junk is going to be paying for this mistake for years. And if we see that, if we don't see them go under, it's only because Funny Junk is so adept at dealing with trolls. So we have a situation where lawyers have to adapt to the new system, or they have to get the internet to change. Now, this may seem impossible, but this is what Carrion is going for. He is trying to intimidate the internet. He is trying to sue everyone who criticizes him in any way. The idea is, if he can intimidate the internet as if you would intimidate a large business, if he can get it to back down, he can go back to his normal operations of sending out these threatening letters. If he fails in these suits, the problem that happens is when he sends out his next threatening letter, even if it's for a legitimate concern, it will be ignored. And we've seen this. There has been a site, charlescarrion.com, registered. He sent out a legal cease and desist letter, and immediately that was posted online, and the person running the site simply said he was going to ignore it. This is the point where Charles Carrion is now in a case, in a situation where his basic method of doing business is no longer effective. So he's trying a Hail Mary. He's trying to intimidate people to give him, to regain his credibility. Whether it works or not is unknown, but it's one of these things that we do have to keep in mind. Carrion's just one man, and he's doing a great deal of damage as one man. He is not a government. He is not a set of a large corporation. He's one man who simply has access to the legal system. If a corporation or government were to try the same thing, we could very well see the internet fundamentally change, come more in line with the legal system, come more in line with the old system of publication, where you had to be careful about what you said online, where there were censorship and restriction on speech. Is this a bad thing? That's really hard to say, because we all know, even though we do have a system online where public shaming is used to resolve conflicts, there are times when that goes awry, when the power is not distributed equally, where one individual has a much larger fan base and is able to skew the facts in their favor, even though they are in the wrong. And we have seen this in the past, and we have seen this happen many times. Carrion made the mistake of going after the oatmeal, which is one of the dumbest things to attack in the history of the internet, with a large radical fan base. The only thing I could think of him doing worse was go after something awful or 4chan, where it would have not ended well for him. But this is the case where we have disproportionate power on the internet, just as we have disproportionate power within lawyers. I think the balance between the two systems is the solution, where both the public outcry and the legal system has to be taken into account. One of the things that also interested me about these interviews was the fact that when I asked what we could do, what the internet could do to express their outrage at this case, both lawyers gave us advice, but the advice was more general. Contribute to these campaigns, send these notes, you can do these various things, but nothing directly affecting the legal system. And that's because the legal system is set up to protect the individual, to protect one person against the mob. The internet is not supposed to interfere with the legal system, and the legal system should not interfere with the internet. Lawyers have to educate themselves on how to deal with the net. They have to understand what they are going to be sending out is going to be taken literally and is going to be seen by many people. And if they send out threatening letters that have no basis, they're undermining their own ability to operate. On our side of the internet, we have to take these legal threats seriously. Everyone. We cannot just simply expect the legal system to work. The legal system is based on laws, and we affect the legal system by affecting the laws. Anti-SLAPP legislation is something where you can have a direct effect on how harassing lawsuits are run in your state. If you're for them or against them, they're something that you should look into, because this is one of the best ways to affect cases like this, changing the legal system. I hope you got something out of this podcast. I hope you found it informative. I definitely did. This is something that I put together out of a labor of passion, and I hope that you have gotten something out of this. If you like this, please say something in the comments. We're considering doing more of these in the future, but they are, of course, rather labor-intensive. So let us know if you like these sorts of things. I'm going to end this from this point on. I don't have a clever ending, so I'll simply say, see you next time.